Good morning, and welcome to the West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship's virtual Sunday service. We are also affectionately known as WUF, and we sometimes refer to our congregants as WUFers. My name is Salima Mawson, and I use the pronouns she and her. It is my privilege to be part of this morning service and to welcome you, whoever and wherever you are at this moment. Please know that you are welcome here, whatever your age or abilities, color of your skin or where you were born, whomever you love or how you identify your gender, and whatever your spiritual practices may be, or if you have none. Know that you are here and we are grateful for you to be here. This morning, especially, we invite you to join your breaking hearts with ours as we grieve the loss of 18 more precious human lives lost to the mass tragedy of gun violence in our country. Stand with us this morning against this public health crisis as we share a minute of silence to honor all the victims of violence who have died this month, not only at the hands of others, and not just in Atlanta and Boulder, but throughout our own communities, our country, and the world. I encourage you to check the announcements in your order of service to see what else is happening this week, and especially to join us for our virtual coffee hour at 11:30, when we will check in with each other, share our personal joys and sorrows, and talk about today's service with our presenters. Now, if this is your first time with us and you don't have an order of service, but would like to know more about who we are and how we stay connected during this time of social distancing, don't hesitate to get in touch with our congregational administrator through our website, whuuf.org. Unitarian Universalism draws from many sources. Wisdom from the world's religions, humanist teachings guided by reason and the results of science, spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions that celebrate the circle of life and the rhythms of nature. This morning service, inspired by that plurality, is a sharing of reflections from two WUF members, Jack Mandeville, who is new to our congregation this year, and the Reverend Catherine Clarenbach, one of our community ministers. Jack is an ever-evolving Christian, and Catherine is a practicing Wiccan. They will begin by lighting the chalice. This ritual symbolizes our shared and plural faith and draws us into sacred space, no matter how scattered we may be. So if you're lighting a chalice at home now, please join me in speaking our opening affirmation. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful. Let us open our minds to learn what is true. Let us open our hearts to love one another.
We light this chalice in honor of the free and responsible search for truth and meaning to which our tradition calls us. We light this chalice in honor of the human heart's search for transcendent awe and immanent wonder.
We light this chalice with joy and gratitude for the pluralism of our shared Unitarian Universalist faith and our welcome of many religious backgrounds. We light this chalice in love. Blessed be and amen. Please join me in a spirit of prayer and contemplation. Sufi Muslims hear your call through the gift of the Quran, and they call to you as the one love. Jews may hear your call in peoplehood and the book, and they can call you Adonai. Christians may hear your call in the acts and example of Jesus, and for them, you may simply be God. Wiccans call you by many names. Naturalist humanists hear your call to wonder in the works of earth, the universe, and human creativity. I honor the human imagination and our ability to find you, each in our own way, gathered here. Grant that our hearts may be open to love Earth, our cherished Eden. Grant that our hearts be open to love one another and one another's ideas, beliefs, and experiences. And grant that our hearts be open to what is not our own, but which others find meaningful. As it says in the Quran, see, I made you many peoples and lands so that you might come to know one another. Let us commit to knowing one another better and let our hearts be open. Blessed be and amen.
So good to be together today. I want to share a story with you about my childhood. But first, I want to tell you the story of the Jewish holiday of Pesach or Passover. Passover, we know the old story of Moses, who was found as a baby and raised as a prince of Egypt. Moses goes through an awakening. He discovers that he is, in fact, an Israelite and that his brothers and sisters are held in captivity. He goes to his brother and says, Pharaoh, please let my people go. As part of his journey of awakening, Moses walks to the top of Mount Sinai, and he has an experience with the divine. And the divine tells him, God tells Moses that his people are the chosen people, that Pharaoh will free them and they will journey to the promised land. God isn't real specific. God doesn't say it will be incredibly hard. There will be plagues. There will be loss. There will be great suffering. You will be in the desert for 40 years. Jews around the world will gather, will gather online to celebrate Passover with a ritual meal called a Seder. They will acknowledge the struggles and strife of the Israelites as they wandered in the desert for 40 years. They will eat matzah, which reminds them of their time in captivity and the rush that they were in to leave. They could not even stay to let their bread rise. Friends, I want to share with you a story of when I was 7 years old and my family went on a sabbatical. We went on a journey together to 21 different countries, and we spent much of our time early on in the sabbatical in the Middle East, and we were given the opportunity to climb to the top of Mount Sinai. And I'm 7. And I am a fairly precocious child. This will come as no surprise to many of you. And I have opinions, and I am not thrilled about the prospect of getting up in the middle of the night to climb a mountain to watch the sunrise. And the night before we went on our hike, we read the book of Exodus, which tells the story of the Israelites' escape from Egypt, their wandering in the wilderness, their eventual finding of their promised land. And I loved the story because it is one of the more exciting Bible stories. Plagues, war, escape, intrigue. We read the story, and around 3 o'clock in the morning, we woke up and we started our long hike to the top of Mount Sinai. And we weren't really sure what we needed to be prepared for. We certainly were not prepared for the track, for the path up to the top of the mountain to be covered in ice. We were not prepared for how cold it was going to be. And we get to the top of the mountain and we stand in silence. And we're not alone. There are groups of tourists, some of whom are standing silently listening to their minister preach to them, and they are standing with their eyes closed. And I can still remember as a young child asking my mom, why are they just standing there with their eyes closed listening? And as the sun rose over the horizon, they opened their eyes. They applauded the sunrise. Friends, we are in a time right now where we may all feel like we have been in the desert for 40 years, where we feel like we have been lost. And I'm here to remind you that one day the sun will come up, we will open our eyes, and we will applaud. We will see the sun come up another day, and we will celebrate.
The Night House by Billy Collins. Every day the body works in the fields of the world, mending a stone wall or swinging a sickle through the tall grass. The grass of civics, the grass of money, and every night the body curls around itself, and listens for the soft bells of sleep. But the heart is restless and rises from the body in the middle of the night, leaves the trapezoidal bedroom with its thick, pictureless walls to sit by herself at the kitchen table and heat some milk in a pan. And the mind gets up too, puts on a robe, and goes downstairs, lights a cigarette, and opens a book on engineering. Even the conscious awakes and roams from room to room in the dark, darting away from every mirror like a strange fish. And the soul is up on the roof in her nightdress, straddling the ridge, singing a song about the wildness of the sea until the first rip of pink appears in the sky. Then they all will return to the sleeping body, the way a flock of birds settles back in a tree, resuming their daily colloquy, talking to each other or themselves, even though the heat of the long afternoons, which is why the body, the house of voices, sometimes puts down its metal tongs, its needle, or its pen to stare into the distance, to listen to all its names being called, before bending again to its labor. And the soul is up on the roof in her nightdress, straddling the ridge, singing a song about the wildness of the sea until the first rip of pink appears in the sky. Then they will all return to the sleeping body, the way a flock of birds settles back into a tree. This is about my journey, the unseen child that grew up to be a man who still loves the unseen light, the light that no one pays attention to. This is me on top of the roof at night in shadows, soaking up the magic of the night sky, free and loved by the earth, free from judgment, free from worry, free from my small town world. Well, I mean, not really, only in my imagination. Actually, I grew up in a very orderly household where I was watched very carefully, probably because I was a dreamer and like a baby mystic. I got invited to Boy Scout gatherings that I promptly ignored or pretended to forget about, football camps and fishing tournaments and card games, and the list just goes on. I was totally not interested in these. My parents, however, were on a mission to successfully insert me into the life they wanted me to live. And they were great parents. And they only wanted what was best for me. And by age 10, I was hanging out in graveyards, straddling the ridge, when the moon was full, and I thought they were places of safety and quiet. I would sit there and imagine all the lives of the people long buried there. Who did they love? Did they have a happy life? What did they believe? I wanted to know all the things. And I'm from the East Coast, so there are still many graves from the 18th century, still intact. And I love those the most. I did grave rubbings as a teenager, and my parents would just shake their head. Why wasn't this boy playing ball with all the other little boys? That just wasn't me. As odd as that seemed to be to the usual observer, I was actually very much in love with church. I was there whenever the door was opened. I don't think I missed a Sunday for many years. In fact, I would go to church when my parents did not. I can remember wondering in amazement when my Methodist minister would say the words of institution over the elements of bread and wine. And me just wondering in amazement how this was any different than a spell. After all, this is my body is translated as hocus pocus, right? Google it. I later learned as an adult how much Christianity had sought to compete with pagan holidays by inserting their own elements, by inserting Christmas and Easter alongside them, mimicking the characteristics of pre-Christian gods and goddesses and turning them into saints. Honestly, this is really where I got started in earnest investigating my multi-faith journey as both pagan and Christian. Anyway, I was born of tradition and privilege, and I was hardwired to be practical, steadfast, and the most southern and gentlemanly words, responsible. Most of that, I believe, is born out of having grown up in the haunted soil of the Old South, the cult of the lost cause. I really can't remember a day without the Stars and Bars, Dixie, or the Graves of the Fallen. This sense of paying homage to the past was as important as understanding how people spent time and resources connecting themselves to the history in the past. I'm not saying that remembering is necessarily something we should move on from. What I am saying is that I can't remember a moment when I wasn't being asked to remember. Remember your manners. Remember your relatives. Remember your ancestors. Remember your friends. Remember your family. Remember to brush your teeth. Remember to write a thank you note. Remember to make the right kind of friends. Remember to be straight. Remember to go to church. Remember to expect to respect everyone, almost everyone. Remember, remember, remember. Remembering the past and my connection to it was kind of a sacrament that was required to move on to the next reality that was created for me. And yet, remembering is a key component of Christianity. We are asked to consume the bread and wine in remembrance of Christ, who died for us. The church calls this anamnesis, in which Christians recall the faithful sacrifice for humankind. So there was a lot of remembering in my life. And so fast forward, I'm here in Portland, Oregon, living way outside the prescribed norms. If you would ask my parents when I was born, where will your son be in 2021? I'm pretty sure that they would not say living across the United States in Portland, Oregon, married to another man, working for churches and living out a multi-faith spiritual practice. So that's more evidence of that ridge walking mentioned in the poem earlier. So why is memory and context important for me when living out my spiritual practice? Because it's important to sift through those occasionally to remind myself where I came from, what got grafted to my current journey, what stuck to me, and or what was left behind. And it's not a static practice. I still sift and keep and toss even today. My journey is an active one. And I haven't just stopped listening to the new ideas and ways that God is offering themselves up to me. The United Church of Christ, a cousin to the Unitarian Universalist Association, has a famous tagline many years ago that said, God is still speaking. And I really love that. That really resonates with me. What I want to say is that I'm dumbstruck at where I find myself now, even theologically. I still love Jesus and the old songs and the Bible and the vacation Bible school and all of those decadent memories of my mainline Protestant past. I honor each one of them and thank them for their presence in my young life. But you know, there was also this little baby pagan seeking to get out, a little wizard, one that knew that there was more to the story, that behind the veil was more than just Bible narratives. There were others to be shared, and yet I followed in line for many years, many decades, seeking to squeeze into a narrow way of being spiritual. As I said earlier, we can thank early Christianity for silencing and co-opting many of those stories because they didn't fit the narrative that was desperately trying to be written. I mean, I was attending church in the morning and playing with my cauldron that belonged to my great-great-grandmother, casting spells. Of course, those are memories of a young, naive child, but I still believe they are indicative of my early love for paganism. It's important to point out that this was instinctual. I was not influenced. I was drawn to magic naturally. And so I held that tension, even to this day, of Christianity and paganism. And so here at middle age, I'm honoring these diverse ways of being myself, but not without allowing some decay to occur. Some old things that have been lying in state, waiting to be claimed by another time. Here in the spring of 2021, it's a fitting image. So much of our world is passing away. We cannot and hopefully will not return to what we thought was normal. It has been said that normal wasn't working anyway, and I quite agree. Even my own faith journey continues to evolve. It might surprise you that all my professional work since I've been in Portland has been in mainline Protestant churches. and I have been working in administrative roles in three different settings, and I can tell you most people in the pews are really having to come to grips with the dark. Keeping the lights on is as important as keeping their faith intact. There's a lot of fear, and I've been on this journey with them, allowing them to share their fears and to be open to taking a walk in the dark. It's easy for me to go there, and I knew the first and last names of people who died 100 years ago from those graveyards, so I'm uniquely situated to talk about closing the doors of a church. The dark can contain new life, both a Christian and a pagan value. I could go on and on about my journey, but what I want you to walk away with is that remembering is a good thing. Walking the ledge of a roof line, metaphorically speaking, of course, and allowing something new to grow in its place is okay. Even with traditional privileged upbringing that is my story, I'm thankful of being this magical creation of the universe, and I'd have it no other way. My charge to you is that if you're feeling cozy for the moonlight and need to stretch your legs, maybe it's a time to walk in the dark. If you're feeling sad and want to listen to the trees, maybe it's time to take a walk in the dark. And finally, if you want to feel your life, your humanity, the dirt beneath your feet, and to know that you are alive, it might be time to take a walk in the dark. Blessed be, and may you find your own unseen light. And I will close with this poem by Rumi. This being human is a guest house. Every morning is a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Treat each one honorably. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes.
Charge of the Star Goddess, as tasked by Jonathan White. Listen to the words of the Star Goddess, in whose womb are conceived the burning galaxies of heaven, and whose body encircles the universe. I, who am the beauty of the green earth, and the white moon among the stars, and the mystery of the waters, and the desire of the human heart, call out to you. Arise and come unto me. I will come also to you, for in me all that exists is made sacred. For I am the font of secrets, and I am the spiral path that the universe dances. Let my worship be within the rejoicing heart, for all acts of love and pleasure are my rituals. And before my face, beloved of gods and mortals, let your innermost divine self be enfolded in the rapture of the infinite. Seek me in the light that is in the darkness, and seek me in the dark itself. But know that your searching will not avail you unless you know the mystery, that if you do not find what you seek within yourself, you will never find it without. For behold, I have been with you from the beginning, and I am that which is attained at the end of desire. So my wife tells me that I have four seasons of spirituality, four seasons of religion in my heart. In the winter, she says, my heart is Anglican as I celebrate Advent and the winter solstice. I've even started a tradition with Jack of listening to lessons and carols over public radio sung from King's Chapel in Cambridge, England. In the spring, Julie says, I am given over to my youthful Catholicism, the days of Lent, remembering what is most important in life, turning toward the depths of my heart to remember what is true and good and faithful to my own deepest, highest self. Then she notes we used to camp all summer, really well into early fall, at Four Quarters Interfaith Sanctuary of Earth Religion. We made bonfires to dance around with only sarongs tied around our waists. We sang and chanted and swam in the creek. We wove the maypole and shared bread and honey and ceremony. And finally, in the autumn, I'm Quaker. My heart begins the descent toward the dark part of the year with silence and stillness, more attention to listening than speaking. In gathered meetings in which I could just feel the spirit that fluttered over the waters in Genesis, settle over the assembly, just waiting for us to notice it. Julie is on to something here, something about my heart and the wide embrace of love. Ultimately, no religious cage can hold my theology. Despite having grown up deeply embedded in an enormous music program of a high church, Catholic church, despite being a teacher, choir director, mezzo-soprano solo cantor, member of two vocal choirs and two handbell choirs, despite playing the piano and the organ for years. And when I came out as queer, age 17, I lost all of that. All that love and security, as well as the richness of ceremony that fed my young soul. Not the preaching, not the scripture. The people, yes, but the ceremony we made was what made it home for me. The turning wheel of the liturgical year, the way the music changed and the colors. The trappings of holy water, incense, the tabernacle, vestments, the music that was home. But I lost my home. All at once, all the music, all the people I used to see every week at rehearsal and at Mass, all gone. And then there was the actual theology of Catholicism. Yeah, I kind of hadn't bothered to think about it too much. Singing and playing and serving the congregation had been enough and more. But when Karl Ratzinger, who would later become, briefly, Pope Benedict I, wrote that homosexuality was intrinsically disordered and came from an inherent evil, well, there it was in black and white. And furthermore, I learned when I was 18 that there were holidays, and not just holidays, but holy days of obligation, the days you had to go to church, that had been declared holy days of obligation in the mid-19th and 20th century. They made it up, I thought. They made it all up. Somehow, along the way, I had indeed internalized the idea deep down that there was something essentially valuable and even eternal about Roman Catholic theology. Something right for me. But then my 18-year-old self said, but they made it up. Even though I had never believed, never, that there was one true way to do religion, my parents had made sure of that. I truly had believed that Catholicism was the way for me. But belief crumbled like a piece of paper balled into a fist. And around this same time, I was introduced to the first pagans, they called themselves witches, I had ever met. They understood that God was also goddess, and goddess was also God, and something inside of me bloomed in joy. It was a homecoming, as we talk about in UU circles, not a conversion, just a shift. Just a small movement to something I had always felt deep down. But we didn't have a rubric. We didn't have a book. No priest at the front of the proscenium sanctuary. No one who had a special line to the divine. Just a bunch of college kids sitting in a circle, sharing what was on our hearts. And what we thought made sense given the season of the year. And about this same time, I became engaged with the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Center County. And there I breathed another sigh of relief. And there I bloomed some more. The ceremony was simple. It wouldn't be unfamiliar to any of you here at WOOF. A standard format, but not always a standard format. And a philosophy of space, of room, consciously and conscientiously pluralist. A theology that expressly made room for the large embrace that I was steadily coming to know is at the center of my spirituality. The free and responsible search for truth and meaning, celebrating and affirming it in every person and acknowledging that it can be, it must be, it is good that it be different in each one of us. Yes, I thought. Yes. And the fellowship taught me one other super important thing. It's all made up. We're all just reaching for something that we need. We are all searching. And given that we're all searching, some of us come up with very different answers than others, and that's okay. In order for a UU congregation to live into the pluralism of our tradition, we have to know that sometimes a given service just isn't for us. It's for someone else sitting near us. That we can think someone's theology is banana pants and still love them. It is good for us to be different and love one another. But I'm Wiccan too, right? Wasn't that the point here? Why and how and what does that tradition look like? My tradition of Wicca, the Stone Circle tradition, began in 1999, where I was one of its founding members. By that time, I had found Four Quarters, the land and place and space to continue my blooming and blossoming, opening my embrace of people of different paths from my own. I still had this longing for a tradition into which I could really sink roots, not just intellectually, not just enthusiastically, but in my body, mind and heart and soul. And in Stone Circle Wicca, SCW, as we call ourselves, I found it. So what are the things we believe and practice? We believe in the power of needs-based ceremony. Just as here at WOOF, we have the Blue Christmas, we have reflected on the pandemic, we celebrate when we're together, chocolate communion, and delight in the joys of spring. These two are ceremonies that respond to human needs to express grief, complexity, healing, and joy. In SCW, we have our own liturgical year, spiraling along, shared with many other traditions based on the cycles of earth and sun. We are a queer-friendly and queer-founded religion with two social justice statements, one regarding our support and welcome of people of all genders, and another regarding police accountability and support for the Black Lives Matter movement. In Stone Circle Wicca, we hear and respond to the divine as one and many, male, female, all and beyond. Beyond. Not just both and neither, but all and beyond. Like other Wiccan traditions, we reverence the directions, those cardinal points of the compass that remind us where we are. We reverence the four classical elements, air, fire, water, and earth, that remind us who we are. And for us, each of those quarters also holds an ethic, a core value. Authenticity, integrity, compassion, and wisdom, respectively. We began our shared life at Four Quarters. That land birthed us and the stone circle that is being built there once a year during a 6-day long festival, ceremonies of commitment, centering, devotion, singing, toasting, fasting, pouring libations, blessing babies, consecrating stones, and feasting come together in the service of raising multi-ton sacred standing stones. And for 20 years, we were part of that. 20 years making ceremonies to attend to joy, grief, sorrow, anger, and love, believing that service and devotion can be ways toward communion with the divine. But so can writing and teaching, counseling and loving, the cooking, feasting, and washing of the dishes, not eating or feasting on the dishes, but what's in the dishes, as well as doing that ever so necessary task, facilitating a well-run board meeting. We believe that while each person is unique in all of history and time, each of us a cell in the universe's body, the most important thing about any of us is that we are part of the big picture. Neither matter nor energy can be created or destroyed. We are eternal in our own way. Birth, life, death, decay, rebirth, recycled over and over. And that connection and that fact, the observable fact that all things affect all other things, is at the center of our beliefs. So finally, let me say this. There is a line in The Lord of the Rings in which the sycophant Wormtongue says to the niece of the king of the horse lords, Eowyn, a line I come back to again and again. He says of the captivity that she's experiencing, that it is the walls of your bower about you beginning to shrink, a cage to trammel some wild thing in. My thought, theology, and practice are wild things that will not be trammeled, caged, kept in captivity. And so, I find myself in two places at once, but both wild places, places that allow for my religiously fluid, spiritually hungry self to move and breathe, to shed blood, sweat, and tears as I wrangle with the big questions, and to have that most beautiful of gifts, community. Blessed be.
As with all things in the household of Earth,
we embrace for a while and then let go.
So as we go, may we go grateful for this place.
This moment, grateful for our kaleidoscope of faith, our many sources and paths.
To the sacred, to the holy, to intimacy with the ultimate and with one another.
Go in peace.
And return in love.
Blessed be.
And amen.